Katie, you've been cheating on me.
I beg your pardon.
Well, this week I turned on the radio and who did I hear chatting about French politics with BBC radio presenter Evan Davies but you?
Yeah, sorry.
Are you leaving me?
We're best friends now.
Have you found another man?
Radio 4 is like scarily huge numbers of people, which I didn't really think about until after I did it. And that's probably for the best.
How many people were listening?
Approximately 60 gazillion million. Yeah, dunno. Loads though. But it was fun to be on the radio.
And in all seriousness, you spoke really well. So I was very proud. And yeah, I'm giving you a free pass to go and talk to anyone you want, especially at this time of French elections. It must be a busy time for you, Katie.
Yeah, gearing up for the election next weekend, doing some reporting around that. More on which next week. But yeah, it's looking less predictable and more scary than it was a few weeks back. But on the positive side, this is my first French election as a citizen here. So I finally get to vote. And it's going to sound really nerdy, but I'm quite excited about voting because the voting system is so different from the UK. And I've never had a direct vote for a president before, and it's exciting. So I think I'm pretty much the only French person who's actually excited and looking forward to Sunday because it's been a quite depressing campaign. But I'm happy to be taking part. Also, in France, they give you these little voting cards, and each time you vote, you get a stamp. It's like a loyalty card at a coffee shop.
Is there any like reward when you've had 10 elections?
Vote 10 times, get one free vote. No, I don't think it works like that. It seems kind of pointless. It is fun though.
In the Netherlands, they give you a free red pencil.
Oh.
Every election. Actually, I think maybe they don't do that. Maybe you're meant to return them, but I always just take them.
Busted.
But today we are not talking about French elections. Today we are going to be looking at something completely different, at the Finnish school system. We're going to be looking at why Finnish education seems to work so darn well. Pasi Salberg is a Finnish educator and scholar, and he will be joining us later on in the show to help us unpick some of the reasons behind Finland's celebrated schools. That's coming up in a bit, but first, it's time to dive into Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a bad week?
Well, deep breath. As many of you may have heard, Viktor Orban's Fidesz party had a huge victory in last weekend's general election in Hungary. Pollsters had predicted it was going to be a pretty close run race between Fidesz and their main opposition, a six-party bloc, who had decided to campaign together in order to try and defeat Hungary's liberal leader, Viktor Orban. But in the end, it wasn't close at all. Orban actually did better than he did last time, with a higher share of the popular vote and coming out with more seats in parliament. The party actually won another supermajority in parliament. That means they have two-thirds of the seats and it gives them the power to change the constitution at will. So frankly, with this election result, it's been a bad week for a lot of people. But yeah, let's start with the Hungarian opposition bloc. It's been a very bad week for them.
Yeah, they did much worse than people had expected them to, didn't they? Like, what went wrong?
Yeah, I mean, most observers and pollsters did expect Orban to win, but not by the amount he did. In the end, 54% of Hungarians voted for Fidesz and 34% voted for the United for Hungary opposition bloc. Why did this happen? Well, it's obviously going to be picked apart for months to come, but one thing is clear. Orban's support had increased considerably in the polls since war broke out in neighboring Ukraine. And whilst Orban did agree with fellow EU leaders to the initial wave of sanctions against Russia, he has been walking a bit of a balancing act between the EU's interests on one hand and the hideous interests of Vladimir Putin on the other, with whom he has ties and some clear personal chemistry. Hungary has, for example, a controversial policy not to allow arms to be transferred to Ukraine at the Hungarian border. Plus, he's the only EU leader to publicly criticize Ukrainian President Zelensky. And whilst this makes him very unpopular in Ukraine and in most of the rest of Europe, Orban uses this ambiguity to frame himself as a vote for keeping peace in the region and to frame the opposition as a vote that would eventually lead Hungary to war. And however cynical that is as an electoral strategy, I mean, especially considering the horrifying war crimes from Russia that we've seen this week, apparently that strategy worked, or at least it didn't backfire. A clear majority of Hungarian voters went for Orbán and for his party.
I mean, I just can't get over the fact that that attitude towards Ukraine would be a vote winner right now.
Yeah, it's grim.
How sure are we that this election was conducted freely and fairly?
Well, it's a complicated question. A lot of people have been using the phrase free but not fair when describing this Hungarian election. And part of that is because of partisan gerrymandering, the drawing of constituency districts to benefit the ruling party. Our listeners in the US will, I'm sure, know all about that practice, but it's not unique to y'all. In the end, the gerrymandered electoral map actually didn't make a huge difference to the final results because it wasn't anywhere near a close race. So, yeah, it really would have had a difference if it was tight and the opposition weren't able to get a majority in parliament, even if they had won the popular vote. But there were other problems, and the opposition immediately accused Orbán and Fidesz of cheating after the results came through. And there are allegations of vote buying and illegal busing of voters. And there was actually a big team of international observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe that came to look and see how everything was running. And whilst they said that actually voting was well run, they were strongly critical about problems with the fact that it is not a level playing field in an election in Hungary, highlighting a few things, including the blurred lines between the state and the ruling party, as well as the lack of balance in coverage of the campaign. And yeah, that's a key thing. As we've talked about many times on this podcast, Orbán and his allies have significantly altered the Hungarian media landscape and made it pretty difficult for independent and critical voices to be heard. And it goes without saying that this makes it just very difficult to have fair elections. It's also worth mentioning that this great hope of a unified Hungarian opposition had a really difficult job in finding a way to campaign together. They were a group of five main parties, ranging from socialists to former fascists, with everything in between.
Poor church.
So it was always going to be difficult to present a unified and clear message, a tangible alternative proposition to what Fidesz was offering that wasn't simply based on being anti-Orbán or anti-nationalist. But it was this glimmer of hope for so many Hungarians that the fragmented opposition coming together would mean finally the end of Orbán, who had just won the last three elections in a row. And I know a lot of Hungarians who support the opposition, who support democracy, are absolutely devastated this week because it's also a bad week for democracy in Hungary. I think there's no beating about the bush there. Hungary is already described by Freedom House as a transitional or hybrid regime in their democracy index after a steady decline in democratic norms over the past 10 years, all thanks to Orbán.
So what does all of this mean for Hungary's relationship with the EU now? Because it's not like Orbán has been the most popular EU leader over the past few years.
Yeah, you can definitely say that. And it's definitely been a bad week for the EU too. They now find themselves in a pretty tricky situation. They have to deal with the fact that Hungarians re-elected this leader who frankly doesn't seem interested in the key ideals of the European project at all. And the EU has been facing a lot of criticism for not having been tougher on Orbán up until now and for continuing to pump billions of funds into the country whilst Orbán breaks down democratic norms bit by bit. They did at least withhold the release of the billions of euros allocated to Hungary as part of the huge COVID recovery fund based on corruption concerns. They will have to decide eventually whether or not to release that money to Hungary. That's going to be a big decision. And on the one hand, it might seem like a no-brainer for the EU to get tough with Orbán. But on the other, the EU is desperately craving unity in this time of war. And Hungary could use their votes within the EU to veto quite a lot of things that the EU want or need to get through. So a lot will depend on how Orbán decides to position himself now. He has this renewed mandate. And actually, a lot will also depend on how Poland position themselves, another country who have been criticized for their own democratic backsliding. Poland and Hungary have, up until recently, mainly stuck together as an ideological bloc when they received criticism from the EU. But when it comes to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, they are very far apart. Poland is one of the strongest advocates for more sanctions against Russia, whereas Hungary is on the other side of the spectrum criticizing Zelensky. What this means for Hungary's position in the EU as it becomes more isolated is going to be very interesting to see.
Mm.
There are obviously many other communities and people for whom it's been a bad week in Hungary. I won't list them all, but I'm sending solidarity to all the LGBTQ plus people in Hungary who have been devastated by this election result and who will have to put up with the continued transphobia and homophobia of the ruling government. The election actually included an anti-LGBT referendum, which in the end failed to become binding because so many people spoiled that part of the ballot. So that's something to celebrate, I guess.
Yay. The questions on that were absolutely insane, weren't they?
Yeah, I'm not even going to go into it now, but they really were depressing. Yeah, and I was speaking to one of my friends in Budapest yesterday and she was just totally drained and emotional. So let's all give our Hungarian friends extra attention and hugs over these next few weeks while they process what just happened. It's an official demand from the Europeans. Hug a Hungarian.
I like that. It's a nice official policy to have.
And as Timothy Garton Ash said in a Guardian piece this week, the Ukrainian horrors are clearly far worse than the Hungarian miseries, but they are sadly fatefully connected, as I've described. So a very bad week for a lot of people. Cheer us up, Katie. Who's had a good week?
I'll do my best, even though I'm going to talk about debt now. That's fun. But it's been a good week for unlikely alliances. So you know how in this beautiful union of 27 countries that we call the EU, there's always been quite a lot of tension over money stuff. And this tension has quite often fallen along north-south lines. Ooh. So if you think about what happened after the European debt crisis from 2008-ish, I'm generalizing here, but you tended to have rich northern European countries like Germany and the Netherlands griping about having to help bail out their neighbors and accusing southern European countries like Greece and Spain and Italy of getting themselves into really terrible financial messes because they supposedly manage their money badly and they're irresponsible and they let everyone retire too young because they're lazy compared to the hardworking northerners. Mm. And a lot of southern Europeans, understandably, got incredibly angry about these stereotypes for a lot of different reasons. I mean, for one thing, it wasn't just southern countries that got into trouble a decade ago. If you think about Ireland, for example, they found themselves in a huge financial mess. And it's debatable how responsible southern European governments were for the difficulties that they found themselves in versus how much of the crisis was because of external factors. But also, if you take the Netherlands, for example, it's kind of up for debate how much of their comfortable financial position with much lower levels of debt is really to do with their hardworking and sensible attitude towards government finances, and how much of it is to do with the fact that the Netherlands is a tax haven, and that quite a bit of tax that should have been paid to other governments, including in Southern Europe, goes in fact to the Dutch one. So there's this idea that a lot of this annoying northern smugness, it isn't really justified. I don't know what you think about that, Dominic, as a Netherlands resident.
Oh, yeah, it's very annoying. Although I'm fortunate not to be surrounded by many people in my own personal life who are supportive of this idea that we can be smug in the Netherlands.
Walking around being smug northerners all day.
Didn't this idea of stingy northern Europeans come back quite a lot during the pandemic when they were deciding how much money to give to southern countries?
Yeah, so the Netherlands, Austria, Denmark and Sweden, they got nicknamed the Frugal Four. Sometimes people talk about the Frugal Five, adding in either Germany or Finland to this like generally stingy collection of countries. But what you saw during the pandemic when this massive package of aid was being thrashed out was these four countries opposing this idea of collective debt, this idea that we should borrow money collectively as a block of countries, as the EU, to help get over the pandemic, and that we should be jointly responsible for paying it back. This is, in the end, something that we are doing for the first time. And it was seen as a pretty big moment. But I'm getting really off track. All of this is background to the fact that this week we saw quite an unusual pairing of countries coming together to jointly call for some new financial reforms. And those countries are Spain and the Netherlands.
That is an interesting and surprising combo. What have they actually come together to suggest?
Okay, it's kind of specific, so bear with me. Basically, both of these countries think the EU should change its rules on the speed at which countries need to pay their debts back. because at the moment, it's kind of a one-size-fits-all policy. So the Spanish government, for example, has really big debts. I think last year it was 118% of GDP, which means that they owe more money than the entire Spanish economy can produce in a year. And to be fair, quite a lot of EU countries are finding themselves with more than 100% debt at the moment because everyone's had to borrow like crazy during COVID. But if you compare Spain to the Netherlands, Spain's debt is 118% of GDP. The Netherlands is only 52%. So it's still, you know, a ton of money, but it's way less compared to the size of the country's economy. And actually, with Spain and the Netherlands, we really are talking about economies that are pretty similar in size. They are the fourth and fifth biggest economies in the EU. Now, even though Spain and the Netherlands have vastly different amounts of debt to pay off, it is down in the EU rulebook that all countries in the EU are supposed to be trying to reduce their overall government debt by a fifth each year, until they can get it down to 60% of GDP.
Okay, so the Netherlands have already reached that target because they're already under 60%.
Right. One thing worth pointing out also is that it's not even necessarily a terrible thing for a government to have this level of debt. So if you look at Japan, for example, their debt is about 250% of GDP, and they're one of the richest countries in the world. They tend to tick along okay. So Spain, in this situation, might rightly be asking, do we really, really need to reduce our debt this fast? Is it really that urgent? Because the fact is that if you want to reduce this mountain of debt, you're either going to have to raise people's taxes or you're going to have to spend less money on public services. So if you're going to listen to these EU rules and reduce the debt by a fifth a year, that is going to feel much more painful for a country with really big debts than it's going to feel in a country with much more manageable levels of debts. It forces austerity. And austerity is, of course, something that has caused a huge amount of resentment over the last decade or so. This idea of some European countries having to starve their public services to pay off debt.
So it does feel like quite a big step to have a country, this stingy northern European country like the Netherlands, agree that Spain shouldn't have to decrease their debt at the speed that the EU have been saying. That's like quite a big deal, no?
Yeah, it does feel like a big deal. And something I should point out is that the EU in general has been really lax over its debt rules over the last few years and really not enforcing them because, frankly, everyone's finances are in a total mess. But this does feel like a step forward, yeah. Especially when you think about how the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, during COVID, he really became the poster boy for these like frugal northern European countries. And he was very willing to get out in public and say all of these things that made him look really mean to the rest of Europe about how like countries like Italy shouldn't get cash to help them recover from COVID unless they were willing to bring in the kind of reforms that he wanted, that kind of thing. And I actually wanted to ask you about that because it felt a lot to me like he was playing to his domestic audience when he did this whole like, I'm the most stingy person in the EU kind of act.
Yeah, it does. And I guess maybe some of the changes because of the new Minister of Finance.
Yeah, actually our producer Katz was also saying that. She's saying that one of the things that's changed lately is that you guys have a new finance minister, Sigrid Kaag. She's a lot less right-wing than her predecessor, and that seems kind of helpful in this context. Anyway, it is early days yet because this is just a proposal from Spain and the Netherlands, which got presented to all the EU finance ministers this week by Kaag and her Spanish opposite number, Nadia Calviño. Shout out, by the way, to the reporters at Politico who had access to that document and went through it and broke the story. But as usual with the EU, it feels like there's something quite hopeful here embedded in something really boring because there's such a history of bad blood on talking about debt in Europe. I remember when I was working in Greece, I would like pick up newspapers and there would be cartoons in there of Angela Merkel in a Hitler uniform, because there was just so much resentment over the way that people felt like Germany especially was forcing this really punishing austerity on Greece. So in the context of all that, this does feel like a little step forward that two countries like this are even trying to come up with common suggestions. There is a bunch of other stuff in this document and some of it is pretty vague, but I will drop a link in the show notes for anyone that wants to take a closer look.
If you would like to keep this podcast up and running, if you think it's nice or important, or even if you think it needs a bit of improvement, why don't you just consider joining our band of supporters on the website Patreon, or Patreon, as Katie just said.
It's Patreon now. That's what the kids are calling it.
Head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast, where you can give us a little monthly donation to help us keep going. And in return, you get little rewards as a thank you. Nothing that impressive or flashy, to be honest, but things that people do seem to like personalized voicemails from us or postcards from Paris and Amsterdam.
I'm actually also down to the last few Angry Macron tote bags, and it's been suggested that the new bag should have, do you remember that picture of Angela Merkel screaming and covered in birds?
Oh yeah, that's a really good idea. I'd become a Patreon if we could give out those bags.
You can't become a Patreon to yourself. It's very weird. I don't know about you, but I have lots of friends with little kids who are starting to think about what kind of an education they want their kids to have. And for me, living between two countries, it's kind of mind-blowing to get a sense of just how different education is depending on where you are in Europe. Mm. So here in France, kids seem to get crazy amounts of homework from the age of like 4 or 5, which I think is kind of wild. Is there anything about how things are in the Netherlands that's different to the kind of education that you grew up with in England?
There just seems to be so many different types of school systems that you have to choose between, like going to Montessori or Jena Plan or bilingual school. It feels like a real like nightmare having to choose.
Well, one system that has perhaps less choice but gets really, really good results is Finland. And it's been getting a lot of attention in recent years, partly because there's some things about the Finnish system that are really, really striking compared to other wealthy countries around the world. Not least that private schools don't really exist in Finland. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. One person who knows a huge amount about the Finnish school system is Pasi Selberg, a former school teacher himself and now a professor of education on the other side of the world at Southern Cross University in Australia. He's written various books about education, including a fascinating one about how important it is that kids play. And we were delighted to speak to him. You moved to Australia with your family a few years ago, and that meant having to decide how to educate your kids there. How was that decision different from how it might have been for a family making the reverse decision and moving to Finland?
It's a world of difference. It's almost the difference is as big as the distance between Finland and Australia. I think if you live in the Nordic countries anywhere, not necessarily just Finland, you don't need to worry that much about where the good school is or whether you can afford education. Here in Australia, everything is different. First thing is that you need to find what people here call a good school. And then the next question is whether you have enough money to pay for that. Everybody pays for education, even in public schools. And of course, in many European countries, and certainly in Finland, that's not the case.
So are private schools not an option in Finland?
We have one private school, meaning that it's fully funded by the tuition fees, and that's the Helsinki International School. But all the other schools are 100% funded by the government.
And something that the Finnish education system is well known for is that kids come out of it having had a fairly equal experience regardless of how rich their parents are. And obviously, you know, the fact that private schools don't really exist is one way of doing that. But how else does the Finnish system help to kind of level the playing field between kids from different economic backgrounds?
What we do in Finland is pay much more attention to kind of a personalized education, an individualized education, looking at the individual circumstances of kids and, you know, their abilities to learn, where they come from. And then the education system is trying to early on support and help, especially those kids who need more support and help. And that's not the case, for example, here. It's a much more underdeveloped, this idea of trying to prevent the issues and problems that kids have. And it's often parents' issue. You know, if your child is not going well in the school, it's, you know, so parents have to take care of that. But then there's a whole set of other things that especially the Northern European societies are paying much more attention to young people outside of the school. You know, we have a specific youth policies that we don't really have here. In a very early part of the kid's life, when they are born, parents have very favorable parental leaves and support, and early childhood education is fully funded in a big part of the Europe, which is not the case here. So what I try to always tell people is that the education system is one thing that can try to equalize some of those things. But many of those things, unfortunately, are without the reach of education because they happen before the kids go to school or when they are outside of the school gate. And this is where many European countries are much ahead of places like Australia or the United States.
I think when people hear about individual attention for pupils in school, a lot of people will see dollar or euro signs and think that sounds really expensive. To what extent is that true? To what extent has money been one of the big reasons for Finland's educational success?
If you simply look at the money in the OECD standards, it's also very cost productive in a sense that you get a lot of out of the euro that you put in the education, that the spending overall in Finland is about the average. If we look at the proportion of the national wealth that countries have, it's much more about where the money is spent rather than how much money is spent.
Something that's really striking in Finland is that you have to have a master's degree to become a teacher. How do you think that requiring teachers to be really highly trained in this way changes the way that they're seen in society?
It's a really good question, because often people say that you don't need a master's degree to teach in a kindergarten or primary school. And that may be true, that you don't need to get the 5 years or 6 years of academic education for that. But what will not happen if you have lower requirements for teacher credential than master's degree is that often young people look for more ambitious and challenging academic programs, and they want to do some real stuff, like what the lawyers and doctors and engineers and architects do. We understood that early on in Finland, if we want to have the teaching profession as competitive and attractive for young people as medicine or law or any of those other things, the basic starting point is to make sure that the students study the same similar degrees at the same level of academic requirements.
Do you think this successful school system in terms of literacy and numeracy, of course, brilliant things, do you think it also creates a fun atmosphere for children in school? Do you think kids in Finland enjoy school more than other places?
Certainly, there are a lot of kids who don't enjoy school. And, you know, Finland is suffering from the same thing that all the other countries in Europe are here, that the older you get in the school, when you go to high school, your true engagement in what's going on in the school declines. So Finland is not that different. But I think that since the education in Finland is not giving that much attention to numerous and literacy and measuring and testing those things and saying that you're good in school if you're good in math or reading or science, that, you know, the Finnish way of telling children what it takes to be good is much more broader thing, that, you know, you can be good in school by, you know, showing some interpersonal skills or social intelligence or emotional engagement to things, you know, simply being a good person. And I think that that is helping a little bit, particularly the primary school and maybe the early years of high school.
You've written quite a lot, I think, about why play is so important for children's growth and development, and how that is to some extent built probably better into the Finnish education system than some others. Why is play so important?
Why not? You know, that's the normal way of children to, you know, make sense out of the world. And if you don't mind, I would actually challenge, say that this is the wrong question. I think we should be asking that, why is it a problem when the children don't play anymore as they should? There's enough evidence from all different areas of human life how more play can benefit children's development, you know, their health and well-being and happiness and many other things. Europeans understand this very well, that play is a human rights issue, and we should not challenge and ask whether it's good or bad. It's a human right for children. And we all Europeans, we have signed this declaration of the right of the child that basically says that every child has a right to play.
Well, it kind of makes me want to go to school in Finland, do it all again. But surely it can't all be great. Are there any things that you think really aren't working in Finnish schools?
Yeah, you know, there's no perfect education system. And this is, you know, if anybody thinks that Finland is a kind of an educational Eldorado where everything is just shiny and rosy and there are no issues. And of course, you know, there are problems. You know, one big issue has been since the last financial crisis that hit Europe really badly in about 10 years ago, funding of education is not at the level where it should be. And at the same time, we have much more diversity and we have many more children who come to school with the challenges and special needs. And at the same time, the funding has been in decline. I think that that's one challenge of Finnish system, is that at the system level, the resources that go to schools and classrooms during the last 10 years has not been what it should be, given at the same time, you know, the 2015 migration crisis that brought tens of thousands of kids in the Finnish schools and classrooms was not really noted by providing new resources. The other one is that Finland, just like many other countries, is now experiencing kind of a challenge of the teaching profession that has been until recently like a number one career choice and option among many young Finns, but it seems like it's not so much anymore, that there's something happening in the schools and the teachers' work that the Finns really need to work out how to make sure that the teaching continues to be seen as a important and valued thing. You know, there's a set of challenges that the education system is experiencing. You know, some of them can be fixed by simply adding funding, a little bit more resources, and again, making sure that they are spent on right things. But then there are things that the schools need to do to make sure that when the kids, when they come to school, that they feel engaged and that they feel that the place is designed for them to learn and make sense of this crazy world around them, rather than that they see school as a place where adults work.
It feels like people started getting really interested in the Finnish education system a couple of decades ago because it was doing really well in this international ranking called PISA, which is a ranking of how 15-year-olds around the world are doing at reading, science and maths. Am I right in thinking that Finland has since slipped down those rankings a bit? Why is that? And does it even matter if they've slipped down those rankings?
Yeah, you know, everybody has been come down. Those who start high, like Finland and South Korea and China now and some others, of course, you know, it's much more dramatic, this decline. But, you know, of course, there are things that, you know, make Finland also declining or dropping down faster than others. Many of those things, we don't know exactly what they are. You know, my favorite theory is that if you were in Finland 15 years ago and you ask teenagers, you know, they're 15-year-olds who take this PISA test, do you have a smartphone? How much time you spend with the screens or gaming and those things? You know, the answers would have been a few hours and, you know, I don't have a smartphone. Now everybody has a phone and, you know, Finnish kids are probably spending more time with their gadgets than, you know, kids in Germany or France or elsewhere. And that's, you know, boys don't read anymore. Kids have all kinds of issues with focusing on things that require longer attention span. So there are a lot of things that can explain this thing everywhere. Most children actually find things like mathematics that requires a lot of thinking and concentration, science that does the same thing, even reading a book that you should sit down and read a book have become extremely difficult, demanding things to do. And it's often because of the changed habits of we want to get everything quickly and fast. And, you know, the pace of media and technology is such a different thing that the kids are just simply learning and adapting to this world of knowledge in a different ways. But to be honest, I think in Finland, that's not such a dangerous topic at the moment, the PISA results. I think it's much more important to try to understand how we get kids back to school so that they're engaged and feel emotionally, you know, part of this community.
I wanted to end by asking you about whether you think the world is noticing how well the Finnish education system is working. Are countries learning from these successes, do you think?
I think the world has definitely noticed that Finland has been doing quite well in these international comparisons. But I think we have also learned that it's fairly difficult to transfer the system or even parts of the system from one country to another. And I think that there have been a lot of disappointments in this respect during the last 20 years. I remember in the early years of France, I went to the cabinet of the prime minister once in Paris, where the prime minister's advisor said that they have adopted Finnish initial teacher education system by doing three things. And I've been doing the same things in Germany, the US and everywhere else. And I think everybody has kind of recognized that there's something different going on in Finland. But I think this mindset that we can go to another country and make a list of things that we like and take them back with our own countries and ask the educators to start to do things like in Finland, it doesn't work like this. I think the much less understood facts are the things that we have been discussing in this conversation, like, you know, the role of play, that why the education system is putting such a kind of a central emphasis or role in this individualized or personalized thing, or why the Finnish system is spending so much attention and time and money to work with the children who have special educational needs in a very different ways. And, you know, those are the things that are much less recognized because they are often invisible things. And what are the visible things? Are the, you know, what the school building looks like, or how many kids you have in a classroom, or where do you train your teachers? You know, those easy kind of low-hanging fruit are the things that people often think are the essential parts of the Finnish model.
While Pasi was talking about the need for kids to play, I was thinking that we need to play more, Dominic. We don't play enough.
So true.
Making this podcast is kind of play, I guess. Thank you so much to Pasi for joining us. The updated version of his super famous book, Finnish Lessons, came out last year. You can buy it in lots of places. And you should also follow him on Twitter. He's there at Pasi_Selberg. So we've been gone for a little while you've been on the farm. What have you been enjoying while we've been away?
Yeah, it's pretty pathetic, actually. I've been away for quite a long time, so I should have built up like loads of isolation inspiration. But we're again at that phase in like pandemic where everything's open. I'm going to rehearsals. I'm making a podcast, having a bit of a social life, sometimes going to the theater. I'm watching a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race, which means that I don't actually have that much time to watch other TV or read books.
You've been neglecting your duties.
I know, and I don't think people need or want to hear my analysis of all the many different franchises of RuPaul's Drag Race every week, only sometimes. So actually this week I'm stealing some inspiration from our wonderful producer, Katz Laszlo, who watched a film that I've been wanting to watch myself but haven't got round to yet. It's called Flea.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's had a lot of buzz from the critics and from awards season. It was actually the first film to be simultaneously nominated for Best Animated Film, Best Documentary, and Best International Feature Film at the Oscars. The film tells the true story of a man who, just before he's going to marry his husband, decides to share his story for the first time with the filmmaker, a friend of his, about his hidden past fleeing his home country, Afghanistan, and moving to Denmark as a refugee. I'm really interested to see it because people like Katz say it's wonderful, and I always believe Katz much more than the Oscar judges even. But I'm also interested in it because it's an unusual film where the audio was made first and then the visuals came second. The animation and archival footage was added afterwards. And I think that's a really interesting order of things, which actually isn't too dissimilar to what we did with our Josh and Franco visual episode, which you should go and check out on our website if you haven't already. But I'm hoping to watch Flea at some time soon. And you probably are too, Katie.
I cannot wait to watch it, yeah.
What have you been enjoying?
Well, given the week that it is, I thought I'd share a couple of my favourite French election podcasts with you. One is in English, one is en français, and the English one is Talking France. It's made by the good people at The Local, a really excellent English language news site, which a lot of you will know. And it's really great. They've been putting out the podcasts every Tuesday, and it's well worth going through and binge listening the back catalogue. It's a mix of interviews and analysis, and it's fun, not too serious, most importantly.
Most importantly. Well, as long as it's not serious.
Fine. It's also really informative. Blah, blah, blah. For you francophones out there, I really want to recommend Parole de France, which is a podcast by Cluster 17, who are a polling agency. And what I find really fascinating about this polling company is that they basically think left and right isn't a useful way to think about politics anymore. So they've come up with 16 different clusters, in inverted commas, of different opinions and outlooks on life, depending on how you feel about things like, I don't know, high taxes and gay marriage and smacking children. And actually, I really recommend that everyone does the quiz to work out what cluster they're in, because I read the summary and it was like, freakily accurate. It was like looking in a mirror, like right down to things like, you probably have an immigrant parent. I was like, how do they know that?
Whoa.
Crazy.
Is it in French though?
It is in French. It'll be good for your French.
Okay.
Anyway, each of these podcasts is an interview with someone from each cluster. And it's just really fascinating. They're like nice little insights into random people's lives all across France and how they think. So if you speak French or if you're learning French, I really recommend it. Parole de France.
For my happy ending this week, I want to celebrate a new world record that was reached last week in Europe. The record for the largest number of spectators coming together to watch a football match played by women ever. It was a match between two old rivals, Barcelona and Real Madrid, a clash traditionally referred to as El Clásico, a rivalry that actually has historical roots that go back to the time of Franco's dictatorship. And I really recommend heading to the El Clásico Wikipedia entry actually to find out about that history. And I found out a lot of interesting things about Barcelona club's position as a symbol of Catalan resistance against Franco. But back to the present for a minute. 91,553 fans came to watch this match in the Camp Nou Stadium. The previous attendance record for a women's football match was at the World Cup in California in 1999. So breaking that record finally is seen in the industry as giving a significant boost to women's football. And There is a hope that this enthusiasm around this match will help create even more momentum and allow women's football to continue growing. Barcelona in particular have received a lot of praise for investment and promotion of their women's team. And it was Barcelona that won this match, allowing last year's champions to progress to the semi-finals of this year's Champions League. I was talking to producer Katz Laszlo, who is now officially our sports correspondent as well as our arts correspondent.
She's done a lot this week. Poor Katz.
I know. And she did grow up in Barcelona, so she was an interesting person to talk to about it. And she actually had a really beautiful reflection after watching the match, which I wanted to share with you. She said, "It was so especially extra joyful and moving to watch these two historically opposing teams being rivals, but also women taking the center stage in a sold-out stadium, the biggest stadium in Europe, after all of the misogyny of Franquismo, making women's history together."
We will be back next week, post-French election. So yeah, we'll be back in your feeds next Thursday with a little debrief on that, probably, as well as assorted other wafflings, as per usual. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
If you want us on Facebook, then come join us on Patreon.
Oh yeah, we're exclusive now. Deluxe.
Katie, you're actually coming to Amsterdam this week, aren't you? I'm very excited.
What have you got planned for me?
Oh, I'm going to take you to my local taco place.
Well, I'm very excited to see you and our football and film correspondent, Katz Laszlo.
Yes, who is one of our producers, as is Wojciech Oleksiak. The show was also produced by you, Katie Lee, and we are members of the Are We Europe audio family. Go and check out their other offerings at areweeurope.eu/audio-family.
See you next week, everyone.
Hi.
Adeo.